From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. As editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine, Ruth Reichel was known for taking on the ethics and politics of food, along with the magazine's traditional recipes and restaurant recommendations. Not all readers were thrilled with the changes.
The first year, we just heard endlessly from devoted subscribers to the magazine saying how much they hated the changes. And I hand-wrote notes to every person who wrote to us.
Ruth Reichel joins us to share her experience guiding the country's oldest food magazine and its ultimate collapse at the beginning of the 2009 recession. It's all next, after the news. You're listening to Forum, and I'm Michael Krasny, and famed food writer and editor Ruth Reichel is with us here in studio. She's written a series of best-selling memoirs, including Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples, and in her new book, Save Me the Plums, she reflects on her tenure as editor-in-chief of Gourmet, the iconic monthly magazine, which closed its doors back in 2019, a victim of the recession. Former restaurant critic for the New York Times and the LA Times, Ruth Reichel joins us to talk about her career, the state of food journalism, her new book, which she says may be her last memoir, and welcome back to Forum.
Great to see you again.
Great to see you. And let me say something about the title, because it's a poem, as many of listeners will know, or evokes a poem of William Carlos Williams, one of my favorite poets. But little did I know, we've gone from apples to plums here, so to speak, a couple of books in between. I guess people, I had no idea that your father did like the jacket of a William Carlos Williams autobiography.
Well, he didn't do the jacket. He did the inside.
Oh, it was the inside.
The
inside. He actually did the design for that?
He did the design for that and for Ulysses, for which he also did do the jacket.
Yeah, well, this is you've got more to tell in terms of memoirs. This is going to be really the last memoir?
I don't know. You know, I feel like I don't know that I have anything interesting to say going forward, but we'll see. You never know.
You always have interesting things to say, especially about food. And, you know, I was thinking in reading your book, I was remembering a line. I don't know who this should be attributed to, because I think it was first said to me on the air by the head of the film festival who used to live with Alice Waters.
Tom Luddy.
Tom Luddy. And then Calvin Trillin claimed that he had the same line, or it was in his text. The line went something like this, that there, all those Berkeley hippies, which you were one of, who were sort of clamoring for revolution and everything, the only one that created a revolution was Alice Waters.
I don't think that's exactly true. I mean, I think there are lots of people who created different kinds of revolutions.
The most lasting, I guess, the most impact, the most enduring. I mean, so the argument would go Alice Waters, no?
Well, I mean, she's certainly been enormously important. But, you know, you look at someone like Bob Scheer, who has, you know, continues to be a really potent voice. I think there were a lot of people who did it. But, I mean, Alice is certainly a true revolutionary. And I learned an awful lot living in Berkeley in those years. Excuse me.
And you thought you'd lose your soul when you went to Glamour, to Gourmet magazine? You were afraid you'd lose that hippie soul that you had?
Well, I was. And I was afraid of corporate America. You know, I'd been a journalist my whole life. I had never made any real money. You know, even at the New York Times, as one friend said to me, you write about a life of glamour, but you don't live it. And, you know, I was going to enormously expensive restaurants on the New York Times' dollar, but I took the subway to the restaurants. And so suddenly I walk into this atmosphere where the first thing they basically say to me is, you got to do something about your hair. We got to get you some decent clothes. You do not look like you don't look like a Condé Nast editor. And I had never traveled first class. And I was standing in line at the airport when I was on book tour when I had agreed to take the job, but I wasn't yet on the payroll. And two Condé Nast, a Condé Nast editor and a Condé Nast writer are getting on the same plane to LA, and they're in first class, and I'm standing in the economy line, and they look at me as if, you know, what are you doing there? And I said, well, I'm on book tour, and publishers send you economy on book tour. And they said, but you're at Condé Nast now. You shouldn't be traveling like that. And it was as if I had joined a club that I didn't know how to behave in. And
maybe you didn't feel you belonged in.
And I didn't feel like I belonged in. And that feeling only got stronger when I actually got to Gourmet. And I never felt that I was there for the rest of my life. And so although I had, I was supposed to have a car and driver, I thought, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm a subway person. And, you know, I took the subway. I mean, there are literally editors at Condé Nast who take a subway, take a car to go one block. You know, they have lunch is coming and they say, you know, call me a car, and they get in the car and then they get out. But editors who've never been on the subway, who had hair and makeup people show up at their house every morning before they went to work. And I didn't want to be that person.
You had some taste of the high life, though. You got to go to Paris and eat at some pretty high-class restaurants and that sort of thing.
Well, we decided to do a Paris issue, and we did do that in true Condé Nast style. My managing editor said, you know, it would be really great for morale if we sent the whole staff to do this issue. And, you know, it won't cost that much more than, you know, hiring freelance writers to do it. So literally the whole staff went to Paris and romped around. And, you know, for me, it was I felt like Cinderella. It was wonderful.
Well, you always had that humble way, and you still do. And that's to your credit, I think. And it's also to your credit that one of the things that was most grievable, I'll use a neologism because I don't think that word exists, for you was all these folks that went with you that you brought into the magazine, and then the hatchets came down. And I remember because actually you were on the air when you got word, or you had gotten word just right after that, I think, that things were kind of closed down. And it was very disconcerting. One of the most disconcerting things was that The New Yorker had pretty much the same number of subscribers, I believe.
Yeah. But, you know, The New Yorker is The New Yorker. And the other difference is that The New Yorker did not have competition within the same company. Condé Nast had two food magazines, and we were competing for the same ads. And so it was a different situation. I mean, they decided that that was stupid, that they should have one Epicurean magazine. And then they looked at both magazines and, in my opinion, made the wrong choice. But
why did they make the wrong choice? But also, I mean, not to diss The New Yorker or anything, but they also made the wrong choice with Epicurious, which was a competitor. All the good recipes went into Epicurious, and it's fascinating to read your narrative about this because you had a vision for, I mean, things were moving onto the internet, and you wanted to go onto the internet, and you had all kinds of bright ideas. And then Cy Newhouse, I'll tell you a story sometime about his offering me a job. That's way in the past, but I was glad to decline. Explain that whole process, I mean, about actually not being able to use those recipes that were going on Epicurious.
Well, from the moment that I got to Gourmet, I started agitating to have a gourmet.com because I could look down the road and see that we were going into a digital future. And I was fascinated by the possibilities of a gourmet.com. And Cy was not interested. And I think he was a genius. And, you know, part of this book is really an homage to his creativity and his vision, but he could not imagine a world without magazines. I mean, he really could not imagine a digital future. And he had had this notion that he would take all of the recipes from all of the Condé Nast and the Advance newspaper publications and aggregate them into one website called Epicurious. And, you know, for us, we felt like we really wanted to control our own destiny and not to give everything to them. And our test kitchen people were furious because Gourmet's recipes were tested to literal absurdity. And one of the hallmarks of the magazine is that the recipes were incredibly reliable. And they were thrown in there with the recipes from every other publication. And you couldn't tell that if this was something from Parade or Self or Allure or Gourmet. It was just, they were all thrown together. And when Cy came to tell me that finally, I mean, this is just a few years before the end, he had decided that we could have a gourmet.com. I was so excited, and I started babbling and telling him all the great things we were going to do. And then he announces that, yes, there will be a gourmet.com, but all of the recipes will continue going to Epicurious. And I was just stunned. I
felt your heart sink.
It really, I mean, I couldn't believe that they were expecting me to build a website with no recipes.
Well, there are recipes in Save Me the Plums. We're talking with Ruth Reichel about her new book, Save Me the Plums. It wouldn't be a Ruth Reichel book without recipes. There's a German apple pancake recipe, a spicy cheese noodle recipe, and a chocolate cake recipe. A lot of this recipes included in books, my memory goes back to Nora Ephron. I mean, she was kind of a pioneer in that, wasn't she?
Yeah, she put recipes in Heartbreak.
Yeah.
I have wanted to put recipes in every one of my memoirs. And actually, every book I've ever written has had at least one recipe in it. And I wanted a recipe in every chapter in this book, but my editor thought it stopped the action. So in the end, there aren't as many recipes as I would like. I have posted more recipes. I call them the lost recipes from the book on my website, ruthreichel.com. But the recipes that are in the book are ones that I really feel that you need that recipe to understand that chapter. I mean, for instance, I do a whole chapter on the testing process, and I feel like you really need to know the recipe that resulted from that testing process.
Well, one of the things about leaving Gourmet magazine was you had more time with your son, Nick. You also were able to write a novel. I mean, some good things came out of it, but you still, there's a process of grieving that you went through, and that's something that a lot of people don't recognize when you have something that's sort of your baby and then you're cut off from it. And you had these people, as I said, who you brought with you, who you felt pretty terrible about.
Well, you know, there is no more exciting thing than collaborating with a group of really creative people. And that was the process at Gourmet. I mean, it was so joyful to watch an issue come together, and everybody would bat it around and, you know, have ideas, and it would change and grow. And it was thrilling. And I loved the people I worked with. I mean, one of the joys of being at Condé Nast was Cy Newhouse said to me, hire the best people you can find. And I did. And the staff was extraordinary. And, you know, we loved each other. And we still, I mean, it's 10 years since the magazine closed, and we still are in constant contact with each other. And I felt really terrible. You know, 65 people I cared about lost their jobs, and I felt like it was my fault.
My producer's saying to me, can we say who Cy Newhouse is?
Yes.
Just for those listeners who may not know the name.
Cy Newhouse, among other, the late Cy Newhouse, was one of the wealthiest men in the world, a billionaire who was the owner of Condé Nast magazine. Of Condé Nast magazines, they at the height of their power, I think they had 29 magazines, including The New Yorker and GQ and Mademoiselle and Allure and on and on and on, and Vanity Fair. And one of the wonderful things for me about writing this book was that I had a great cast of characters. He was a truly eccentric billionaire who hired eccentric people. So the top of the organization.
I told you he wanted to hire me. That's
what did he want to hire you for?
Oh, he gave me this whole spiel about I was working on a PhD in literature, and I had at that time very little, if any, interest in journalism other than publishing some articles. He said, you want to run a magazine? I mean, just that's the kind of guy he was, you know, just very directly. You want to run a magazine? I said, I don't really have that much experience, and I don't know that I'd make a great editor or anything like that. He said, I can fix you up with that.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what he said to me. You know, you want to run a magazine, and I said, are you crazy? I can't run a magazine. And he said, no, I have a feeling about you. You can do that. And that's the kind of guy he was. I mean, and the people he hired, I mean, he had an editorial director who I, you know, was just incredibly creative and really, really interesting mind. And the publishing side, the CEO of the organization, was like a character from an opera. I mean, just a larger-than-life character. And they were the opposite of bean counters. And part of what I wanted this book to be is a cry for that kind of creativity in a corporation. And part of what the book is about how it went from this organization that was eccentric and strange and really worked because of its eccentricities to becoming more and more corporate, and the bean counters come in, and suddenly you're spending all your time writing reports instead of, you know, really editing your magazine. And it's about the end of that culture and how sad it is.
Well, you hit the internet, you hit the recession. I mean, there were so many things that led to the downfall of so many magazines, although food journalism has taken a whole different spin. I mean, it's in a different world now. You know, I was reading an interview you did, and you were talking about all the magazines that now include food journalism, and a lot of it tied to health and so forth. But you were in the golden era, and yet it's a kind of a different epoch now, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, we are still in the middle of a, you know, publishing media revolution. None of us really knows where it's going to end up. But, you know, the computer changed everything in media. And, you know, we got caught up in that. And, you know, the people who could imagine a digital future are the ones who survived the best. I happen to think that the possibilities are extraordinary, that, you know, someone will come up with a way of balancing what you can do really well digitally and what you can do in print. And we'll combine both of them in a really extraordinary food publication.
Do you have some tea leaves there that you can be more specific?
Well, I think there are things that digital does really well. And I think there are things that you can only do in print. And I think food is the perfect medium for that. And, you know, what we see is more and more really great reporting on a lot of the things that I'm interested in food, in, you know, talking about race and gender and social justice and sociology and science, all of which I tried to bring into Gourmet. And that a lot of that can happen really well on the web. What we're not seeing very much of right now is the kind of wonderfully imaginative things that print can do. And I always thought of those, you know, those food spreads that we did, you know, the wonderful, you know, 10, 12 pages of a meal that we actually storyboarded and, you know, really tried to think of what was happening around that table. And I think of, you know, people taking those to bed and dreaming on them and it, you know, giving them, you know, wonderful ways to think about food and imagine what they're going to cook. And I don't think that we're seeing much of that anymore. And I think we miss it.
Well, you were able to do so many innovative things there. I mean, you know, I think about some of the covers. The cupcakes caused a whole kind of mini scandal. And then you did raw fish on the cover. You also published, a lot of people don't know this, some pretty extraordinary writers. David Foster Wallace, for example, writing about lobsters and the humane feeling of doing, I'm thinking about Woody Allen, you know, with that lobster and that scene in Annie Hall. I mean, you did some things that were really, talk about the cupcake scandal, for example.
Well, the cupcake was a really interesting moment because we put a cupcake on the cover and people wrote in and said, that was the most disgusting cover Gourmet has ever published. Low, gross. And one woman actually said, I found that cover so offensive, I couldn't look at it. I had to tear it off and throw it away. And I thought, we're talking about a cupcake? And this, I'll admit I stirred the pot a little. We printed the anti-cupcake letters and then people would write in and, you know, defend the cupcakes. But it took me a long time to understand what the flap was really all about. And what it was about was that for the longest time, the world of food had been very small and that there were a group of people who thought that they owned it. They thought that fine dining was theirs. And it was very, you know, Eurocentric, and they loved having, you know, beautiful souffles on the cover. But to them, putting a cup, cupcakes were, they were children's food. They were, you know, the land of Hostess and Snowball. And we had unwittingly pointed out that food had changed and that the world had gotten much bigger and that food no longer belonged to the elite, that food had become part of popular culture and that the food trends, which for all of human history had come from the tables of the elite down to the people, were suddenly coming up from the street, and that young people were claiming food as theirs. And the old guard readers of Gourmet understood that we were really pointing out that they were being dethroned, and they didn't like it one bit.
Talking with Ruth Reichel, and her new book is called Save Me the Plums. You've had quite a career in food journalism and in food writing. I think probably in terms of food writers who are in there are a Food Writer Hall of Fame. You know, I think of M.F.K. Fisher, Ruth Reichel. Those names come immediately to mind. Any real descendants that you passed the torch to? Who's doing really great food writing now, in your judgment, or food journalism?
You know, I think there is a whole generation of young people today who are doing such extraordinary stuff. And, you know, to begin with, I mean, what's happened here in San Francisco, this, you know, new young food critic, Soleil Ho, I think is remarkable. I mean, she's so smart. She's so interesting. And she's, and many people of her ilk. I mean, in L.A., you've got Tejal Rao, who's at the New York Times, and you've got Patricia Scarga at the LA Times. And these are people who are asking themselves, what should food criticism be today? This is a different time. It shouldn't be consumer reporting anymore. It's not anymore about how do you go out and spend your dollars.
It's a lot more political than it's ever been, isn't
it? It's a lot more political, and it should be. And, you know, food is now in a very different place in the culture than it was even 10 years ago.
Let's take that thought and invite our listeners to join us. What do you think about food in our culture, popular culture or otherwise? And what do you think about food journalism? Where do you read things that really interest you and sustain your interest with respect to food? And what are your interests? You can join us at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that now. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us with Ruth Reichel, 866-733-6786. And always talk about restaurants with Ruth Reichel. We'll get to that as well, I hope. But let's hear from you. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with food writer Ruth Reichel and talking about her career, the state of food journalism, and her new book, which is called Save Me the Plums, and talking a little bit off air about restaurants. And I must say, well, this is I'll put it as candid as I can. Things have changed in terms of, I think, what people look for in restaurants from our era, and have changed dramatically. It changed for me personally. I like restaurants that don't have a lot of noise now. That wasn't a big factor in my youth, but it has become a big factor. And I like restaurants that sort of fulfill kind of political checklists. I don't mean, you know, have to be politically correct, whatever that means, but, you know, just are in consonant with my own feeling about what food should be.
Well, I have to say, Frank Bruni wrote a piece in the New York Times about how now that he was 50, the ripe old age of 50, he liked quiet restaurants. And I read it and thought, you know, he's not old enough to be that old. And I really don't feel that way. There are times when I want to go out and have a wonderful quiet evening, but I also sometimes really like the noise and energy of a restaurant. And
sometimes But if you want a good conversation, if you want, you know, serious conversation, you're not going to find it in a place that's noisy. You can't.
Right. But, you know, you choose. I mean, I was actually at the New York Times. I was the one who started putting in the noise level as one of the things in the boxes. Because I thought that was important. And you should know that, you know, you're not going to be able to have a conversation in this restaurant. But sometimes you just want to go and, you know, enjoy the food and, you know, savor the atmosphere. And, you know, a restaurant is a kind of theater, and you have to sort of choose your theater carefully.
Food is so central to you. Just as you were speaking now, you know, it was a giveaway along those lines. There's food that is often thought to be aphrodisiac. Do you believe in that?
No, I do not believe in that. It's like
even seafood, as they say.
Oysters. I mean, oysters are wonderful, and they can be very sexy to eat. But I don't think that they actually do anything to your libido.
Could you, before we go to our callers, I just wanted you to tell a story that's in your book right after 9/11 about a goat and actually bringing a goat into table.
So after 9/11, one of the cooks and one of the young assistants came to me and said that they wanted to write a piece about a halal butcher shop in Brooklyn. And it was a place where you went and you picked a live goat, and they butchered it before your eyes. And
some people may not know what halal is. It's the right Islamic type of eating.
Basically. Yes, yes, it's like the Islamic version of kosher.
Yeah,
and they actually ended up writing a really beautiful piece about this whole ritual and how the butcher prayed over the goat and thanked him for his life and. Slaughtered him and then cut him up. And he hands the goat to Ian and Alan and says, I know you guys will treat him well. So they come back to Four Times Square where Gourmet is, and they have this goat in these two big plastic bags, and you could literally smell them from halfway across the building. I mean, it was like the smell of the abattoir was so intense. And I said to them, I can't believe they even let you in the building with these bag of warm goat. And Ian said, well, the guards weren't happy, but the elevator door was just closing. We flashed our passes and ran into the elevator. And I said, God, I hope nobody was in there. And he said, well, Anna Wintour was in there.
Yeah, I love that story. Let me get some callers on here. And let's go first to you, Colette. You're on. Morning.
Hi. Good morning. I'm so looking forward to reading your book, Ruth. I just wanted to share that I, as a young girl, got a Gourmet magazine subscription at around 13, which was in the early 2000s. And right around the time of my parents' divorce, it really was just a salve to my weary heart. And we were able to make delicious recipes and connect with the world in a very unique way. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, because that's exactly what we were trying to do.
And you say, I'm using your language now, they murdered the magazine.
Yes, well, that's what I felt was that the magazine did not really belong to Condé Nast. It belonged to the readers. I mean, the magazine was almost 70 years old. And there is literally not a day in my life that has gone by since the magazine closed that someone doesn't say to me how much the magazine meant to them. I mean, not my magazine, the 69-year trajectory of the magazine.
Can I read something here from Nelson? It says, my late mother kept every issue of Gourmet from the 60s until her death in the 80s. I was very sad to get rid of them, but I had no option. I have the two large volumes. And another listener, Daniel, says, I was inspired by Ms. Reichel's cure for her depression after Gourmet closing by going back to cooking in her kitchen. Such a beautiful thing. William wants to know, does Ms. Reichel have any favorite cooking shows she would recommend? While finding recipes is nice, watching someone create a dish can be enlightening.
There is so much good food TV right now, Samin Nosrat, Salt, Fat, Acid, which is wonderful.
Do you like the chef battle type stuff?
I was a judge on Top Chef Masters. I don't love those shows, frankly. But I do love Chef's Table and Mind of a Chef and Ugly Delicious. And what Tony Bourdain brought to food television was extraordinary and important. So, I mean, I am very grateful to food television. I think it changed the landscape of food forever in America.
Quick tweet from Aubrey. I'd love to hear Ruth Reichel's opinion on the future of gourmet food without meat. By the way, before you go on about that, have you tried an Impossible Burger?
I have.
And?
This is a couple of years ago. It had so much other stuff on it that I literally thought that I didn't know I wasn't eating meat. And I took half of it back to a friend and I didn't tell him that it wasn't beef. And he thought, oh, good burger.
It tastes just like beef to me, but it's also kind of crunchy. And the texture of it is very different than, say, a burger of any kind, I thought. Even a turkey burger just tastes different in terms of its texture.
But, for all the people who want burgers with, special sauce and onions and tomato and all that, it's a really good substitute. And I think, these alternative meats are definitely in our future.
So the question was about gourmet food, though. I mean, and your thoughts on gourmet food.
I am upset by what is happening in this country, which is that we now have a two-tier food system, and that has to change. And, I think it's wonderful that those who can afford it can get, food that's been picked by angels that has never seen a pesticide. And I think it's terrible that the people who are picking that food can't afford to eat stuff that's real. And I think it's shameful that we cannot create a country where everyone can eat good, wholesome food.
What do you say to the food snobs? And there used to be just mainly wine snobs. Now there are a lot of food snobs, not even having anything to do with politics, just, what's right to eat, what's proper to eat even.
Well, I mean, people who are thinking about what's proper to eat, I would not call food snobs. I wish everybody were thinking about what's proper to eat.
I wasn't even thinking politically, though. It's proper because it's more sophisticated, to eat or something.
Well, that's just silly. It's just silly. I mean, there is no such thing as what's proper to eat. And, eating is learned behavior. One of my favorite pieces we ever did at Gourmet was I got Fuchsia Dunlop to take a trio of very high-end Chinese chefs to the French Laundry and Chez Panisse. And they were appalled by the food because their food ways are just different. They don't eat raw food in China. They thought a salad was stupid. They don't eat cheese.
You mentioned the French Laundry. When Thomas Keller was on the program, he admitted to loving In-N-Out burgers, and I suppose some people may have found that shocking.
Well, every chef will tell you, some secret love, and you're shocked by, the fact that they actually eat those fast foods.
Talking again with Ruth Reichel, and let me go to more of your calls. You can join us, by the way, at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. And here's Donald. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Really enjoying the program. And my question was the way that Ruth was describing the recipes of gourmet being really thoroughly tested was something that sounded great to me, because with the internet, there's so many recipes available, it's hard to find, kind of curated and well tested ones. I was wondering, is there anywhere to find, the archives or, backlog of gourmet recipes, or are they kind of just out there floating in the ether?
No, they are on Epicurious now, and they are now identified as recipes from Gourmet. And gourmet.com, what is left of it, is still up. They've never taken it down. And I don't get a penny from this book, even though I edited it. But there are two big gourmet cookbooks, giant. And those recipes really, really work.
Let me thank the caller and go right to another caller. And that's you, Roma. You're on. Good morning.
Hi there, Michael.
Hi.
This is Rima from Pleasanton, and I just wanted to first off just thank you for having such interesting topics at in Forum. And I also wanted to thank Ruth. I think food is such a wonderful way to connect with different people, different places, especially in a very politicized country as we have it today. I think, you know, having some food memories to share is a great thing. I also wanted to comment on what Ruth said before, that, you know, food is no longer very elitist. It is, and I think it's also because of all of the cultural diversity that we have in this country that's brought a whole, you know, plethora of different foods and different cuisines that everybody can share and enjoy.
That's absolutely true. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Rima. Good to hear from you. And another caller joining us, Nancy, you're on. Morning.
Good morning. I was just I was really enjoying the conversation. And then when you said that food critics are political and they should be, I was really taken aback by that. And I wondered if you could expand on that. I don't know what you mean.
What I mean is that for the longest time, food critics in America tended to be white and male. And now we are hearing from all kinds of younger people, people of color, and they are taking into consideration not just what's on the plate, but how the food got there, who's cooking it. They're thinking about conditions in the kitchen. And I believe that all of those things are legitimate. I think that modern restaurant criticism can do more than just tell you, go to this restaurant because the food is delicious. And they are telling you, they're giving you, you know, great information about where the chefs come from, where the recipes come from. They're thinking about things like cultural appropriation of dishes. Is it correct for someone who's not Mexican to be cooking Mexican food? They're considering those questions. And they're questions that, you know, thoughtful restaurant goers should be thinking about.
Also thinking about farm workers and the difficulties that they face in terms of working out in the fields. But also here in San Francisco, you know, we have a unique problem in that restaurant workers, I'm talking particularly about servers and people who work in the kitchen and everything, can't afford to live in the city anymore. And so that becomes a big political issue as well. And it becomes an issue for those who employ them, obviously. Let me thank the caller. And a listener asked, please ask Ms. Reichel how she feels about food reviewers ignoring restaurants with chefs accused of sexual misconduct. And you actually mentioned Mario Batali, But what, I mean, that's, again, in the political realm. And just how much ought it to be considered?
I think it should be considered. I mean, I actually have to say that the Me Too moment is not relegated to restaurants. I mean, it is across, you know, corporations in America, it is in Hollywood, it is in the media. And one of the things that's happening, and I think it's partly because so many critics are starting to consider, are the working conditions good in these restaurants? Restaurants are changing. I think it is the industry that is doing the most to correct the abuse of any industry in the country. And Food and Wine just ran a wonderful piece about 19 restaurants that are good to work in, where they, you know, give people benefits, health benefits, and so forth. And I think that that's a legitimate thing for a restaurant critic to consider.
And the whole farm-to-table movement has really, in many ways, taken over much more than any of us would have anticipated. Huh?
I would have anticipated as a Berkeley girl.
But I mean, in the sense that it's really permeated, it's become, you know, part of American life now everywhere.
Well, I mean, the thing that has happened, and I still think we're not acknowledging this enough, is that when I started writing about food, and we're talking about 50 years ago, you would go to Europe and the food would be wonderful because you were getting tomatoes that were picked that day, and what we got from in this country was supermarket food. I think today the food in America is the best food in the world. I mean, we're raising really, you know, delicious animals. We're raising wonderful crops. We're diversifying the crops. I mean, there are cheesemakers all across America and charcuterie makers and incredible bakers. And we are really blessed. And that's the farm-to-table movement.
I'll read a comment from Andres, who says, I am a millennial food lover and a person of color, and it has been healing for me to learn more about flavors and ingredients and their cultural origins. I feel That is what contemporary food culture is attempting to do, bring folks back to their roots and honor them. I'm thinking especially of David Chang's Ugly Delicious or the book Decolonizing Your Diet. It has given me a deeper connection to my history and deeper connection to others. And we'll go to more of our phone calls. And let's begin, let me welcome Brian from Oakland. Good morning.
Hello, love the show. Really interesting topic. I was curious if your guest would speak a little bit more about the two-tiered system in food, having worked in the Bay Area. It's pretty disgusting how expensive things are. You know, it's romantic and perfect lighting and perfect person seating at the table. But as soon as you go in the back, everything is broken up. Tiles are falling apart. People are slipping and sliding. And then these foods just aren't accessible to people. So, and then just really quickly, I wanted to ask you about some of these sort of alternative cooking shows that are coming up. And have you heard of one by a rapper named Action Bronson called F That's Delicious? It's a wonderful show, and I was curious what you thought about it. Thank you.
Okay.
I will watch it. I will go home right now and cue it up. I don't know that cooking show.
What about his comment, though, about, you know, very different behind the scenes? So often that's the case, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, it unfortunately, you know, it's down and out in London and Paris, and things haven't changed that much, and they have to change. And that's why I think it's important that, you know, modern restaurant critics are taking those kinds of things into account. You know, what are the conditions for the workers in the kitchen? You know, is it possible for a working mother to work in this kitchen? Is the chef sexist? And on the two-tier system, I mean, this is something that we really have to address at the government level. You know, there is a reason why when you go out to eat, a hamburger is cheaper than a salad. And that's because of the way we subsidize agriculture. And we have to change that. And that's a big thing to change. But I don't think anything is really going to change on that front until we demand that the government change their taxation policies.
And what about those who say we shouldn't eat meat at all because of the environment, because of the cost of to the environment of actually raising cattle and killing them and using them for beef?
You know, I am glad that people are thinking that way. I think that if you support small farming, which I do, it depends pretty much on also having meat animals as part of the whole system. I mean, I personally believe we should eat less meat, but I applaud people who, for ethical reasons, don't eat meat. I'm not one of them.
Yeah, well, I applaud them too, but I'm also not one of them. Here's Gina, says, how does Ms. Reichel view the food miles question, given that it's largely elite restaurants that serve local beef at a high price? Bay Area chefs turn up their noses at quality cuts of meat from pasture-raised cattle that may be imported but are at a more accessible price point to diners.
You know, there is a whole issue to be raised about, you know, the whole idea of carbon footprint and local food.
And beef again.
But also, for instance, lamb. There was a really interesting study about New Zealand lamb, despite the fact that it is coming from halfway across the world, actually has a lower carbon footprint than most locally raised lamb in the United States. And, you know, if we're going to use that argument, we have to be very careful about how we study it and understand what really goes into carbon footprint.
Ruth Reichel is our guest. Her new memoir is called Save Me the Plum. She was former restaurant critic for the New York Times and former editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and is the author of many other books, including Tender at the Bone and Not Becoming My Mother. And let's get some more callers on here. Let's go to El Sobrante and welcome Lindy. Good morning.
Hi, this is Lindy in El Sobrante. Ruth Reichel is one of my heroes. I'm sitting here. You just mentioned that you've been writing books for 50 years, and I've got the book that's 50 years old, the one that's called
Oh, my God. Very few people have that book.
And I love it. I love it. And it's all stained with, you know, bits of recipes inside it and my notes about modifications I made. And I just love the names of, I love the photographs of you as a child in it cooking, and the names of the chapters, things like Fat Food for Lean Times. I love things like that. And the way you influenced me was I went on to teach people how to have dinner parties in their homes. So it actually became part of my life. And I just want to thank you and say, you're wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you so much for that. Writing that book, I mean, I wrote the book when I was in my very early 20s, and it is very much a document of its time. But basically, you know, not much has changed about my ideas about food since I wrote which I wish someone had told me that people would be embarrassed to go into a bookstore and say, do you have
Well, but they could have been saying the holy syllable It sounds very similar to that. I mean, thank the caller. Lindy, thank you for the call. I mentioned your book, Not Becoming My Mother, and your mother was an enormous influence on your life, and you've written about her mental illness, and that was probably, I would imagine, very difficult to tackle as a writer.
It was, but because I had made my mother a kind of comic character in my first book, Tender at the Bone, I really felt that I owed it to her to try and write her book and explain what her life was like as someone who was bipolar before they even understood what bipolar was. I mean, my mother was a poster child for, you know, the crazy manias and then the terrible you know, months and months after she would crash, she would just go to bed and stay there for, you know, months. And I wanted to write what it was like to be a person who, you know, wakes up every morning not knowing who you're going to be. You know, am I going to be manic Miriam or depressed Miriam? And this book is very much an homage to the women of my mother's generation who were the first group of really educated women in America who were very smart and very educated and not allowed to go to work. And, you know, I feel like my generation stand on their shoulders, and I wanted to acknowledge that.
Yeah, it comes across beautifully, by the way. Taya says, I've always wondered how Ruth Reichel managed to write and publish two books while serving as the editor of Gourmet magazine. Where did she find time and energy?
That's a very good question, and it's a little bit what I tackle in Save Me the Plums is managing your time. And how I wrote those books was I got up really early every morning before the guys were up, and I would write for 2 hours before I woke them and made breakfast for my husband and my son. The truth is you find time for what you think is important. And one of my feelings, I mean, I always did know I was going to eventually lose my job at Condé Nast, but I really thought, you know, I am never going to let them think that they own me. I am going to have something that is mine outside of this magazine so that when the inevitable happens, I will have something to go to.
When you go into restaurants now, they know who you are still? Or you don't have to go in with any disguises or anything like the old days?
Right? I don't go in disguises. I'm not a restaurant critic anymore. I can't do anything for them. So.
But they still probably recognize you, many of them, don't they?
They do recognize me.
You're a public
me.
Person.
Often, yeah. Yes. Yeah. They often recognize me and treat me very nicely, yeah. And I'm grateful.
A comment from Michael. The food system is tied to almost everything. In these challenging social and ecological times, food must become political. Current food writing reflects this and is more diverse and interesting than ever. I love Ruth. Food news sites like Civil Eats and the many emerging voices.
And amen to that.
Here's another caller joining us. It's you, Nick. You're on. That's the name of Ruth's son. Go ahead, Nick. You're on the air.
Hey, Ruth. My name's Nick. You reviewed my daughter's restaurant, Kofax Coffee, back, I think, in 2017. And as a result of that review, part of it, she was able to open a new restaurant in L.A., and I just thank you for your influence for her.
Oh, well, I mean, she is very talented, your daughter. You should be very proud.
We're talking about Nicole Rucker, just the plug.
Yes, yes. I like her new restaurant, too.
Thank you for the call, Nick. Good to hear from you. And a listener writes, I buy your books because of the recipes, and my favorite is your lemon souffle. I think you should buy them for other reasons as well, but let me read another response. This is a tweet from Alice A., who says, to avoid writing my dissertation, I spent hours every day shopping to prepare a meal in Gourmet magazine and then spent hours preparing the meal. What a great distraction. I eventually finished my dissertation, and I celebrated, of course, by cooking a Gourmet magazine meal.
Well, and she's got it exactly right, because there is no better combination than writing and cooking.
Let's get a quick call on from San Jose. Tom, we got seconds left, but they're yours. Hi.
Hi, this is Tom. Thanks for taking it. So I want to get her take on that Oberlin protest of an attempt to make what they call a banh mi with pulled pork and coleslaw, and protesting the inauthenticity of what is a fusion cuisine anyway.
Well, you know, the whole authenticity question is really interesting and really complicated, but I don't think anybody owns any recipe.
Well said. Ruth, always glad to have you, and congratulations on your most recent book. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Ruth Reichel's new book, again, is Save Me the Plums, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You're invited to continue this discussion online, going to kqed.org/forum. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program, and for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.